The first case is 041 Academy of Medicine of Cincinnati versus Aetna Health. Mr. Coleman.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Chief Justice Moyer, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may. The Court of Appeals' improperly restrictive scope analysis reverses the historic presumption in favor of arbitration and wouldn't permit arbitration unless the elements of an asserted claim depend as a matter of law on the party's contractual agreement. That analysis cannot stand for several reasons. First, it is not faithful to the statutory command of the Federal Arbitration Act or the Ohio Arbitration Act, and it is contrary to the party's intentions expressed in the expansive language used in the party's arbitration clauses, which we believe clearly cover this dispute. Second, it is contrary to a long line of precedent stretching from the Supreme Court's decision in Mitsubishi through a long list of Court of Appeals decisions and state court decisions right on down to the Second District's decision in Champaign Landmark, all of which require arbitration of antitrust claims. Third, it unjustifiably excludes from the purview of arbitration, tort, and statutory causes of action, and it invites gamesmanship by encouraging plaintiffs to artfully plead around their contractual obligations to arbitrate. And fourth, it is not even consistent with the Fazio decision on which it relied, because that court properly recognized the strong presumption in favor of arbitration and applied an inclusive rather than exclusionary scope analysis. I hope the members of the court will ask themselves, and frankly opposing counsel, if these expansive clauses, which we have in our arbitration agreements, do not cover the antitrust claims alleged in this case, then what clauses could?
Counsel, let me ask you. I voted to allow this case for review on the merits, but I thought there was a legal issue here upon which we could write. What's the principle of law that it appears to me that the Court of Appeals here applied existing law, and it may be error, may not be error, but what's the rule of law that we can write here that will help the bench and the bar understand this issue better?
As I understand the question presented, there are two sub-issues that are contained. The first is the issue of may a court apply federal law? And when parties have asserted a right to arbitrate under the Federal Arbitration Act, we believe that that court must apply federal standards. Now, we don't believe that there is an inherent conflict between Ohio law and federal law. This court has made clear in a number of decisions that it does rely on federal precedent in evaluating or interpreting the Ohio Arbitration Act as well. And therefore, we don't think that there's necessarily a conflict. But I do think it is clear from the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions that when you assert a right to arbitrate under the Federal Act, then federal standards do apply. Now, we also believe we have a right to arbitrate under the Ohio Act as well. The second part of the question presented, as it was phrased, is may you apply a standard that inquires whether the action may be maintained without reference to the party's agreement or relationship. Now, that is but one of the articulations that the federal and state courts have used in applying what we call the Touch Matters standard. And as that is applied to broad arbitration agreements, and make no mistake, we believe that the arbitration clauses that are before the court today, and there are some slight variations as the court knows, that these are the broadest clauses that parties could possibly write.
Is there any matter that you think would not be subject to arbitration?
Well,
Based on this broad language that you're telling us about, can you conceive of any matter that could arise which would not be arbitrated?
I think I can conceive of a matter.
Tell me an example of one that you think would not be subject to this broad language.
The court in the Fifth Circuit in the Ford case drew a very narrow line. Almost all of the claims in that case were, in fact, sent to arbitration, but they said that certain false advertising claims, and that's advertising to third parties, that actions that were directed away. I will say, however, that I think it's difficult to conceive of a claim that would not be arbitrable under the United analysis, which has no limitations on tying it back to the contract, but simply says any dispute about the party's relationship, and that therefore, you know, if there's anything there that touches the party's business relationship, then I think that it's arbitrable. Now, it is also possible that there might be different, a hypothetical situation in which there are, these businesses have touch each other in different ways, and that one aspect of the relationship has an arbitration clause, and that everything relating to that would, in fact, be covered.
Then if you can go back to the Chief Justice's question, what rule of law do you want us to write here that says that? Or don't we have that already in the law?
Well, we believe that this court has previously stated the touch matters standard, which we believe applies here. What is absolutely clear about what the Court of Appeals did in this case, although it cited the standard from the Fazio case, it in fact ultimately applied a standard that depends on the elements of a claim, that it depends on the legal labels that one puts on a cause of action rather than the context in which the claims arise. That type of a standard is entirely divorced. It doesn't even look at the language of the parties' arbitration agreements. It doesn't interpret the scope of those agreements. It just says we have a legal rule, and if the elements, which is different from, you know, how you state your claim, what are the factual connotations, don't depend as a matter of law, then we're going to exclude you from arbitration, which is contrary to this presumption that exists under both federal and, we believe, state law.
Counsel, you're here on a very narrow question. Are you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your basis for saying, because the question is whether the action could be maintained without reference to a contract relationship at issue, an inquiry into that. And you're saying the answer is no?
No, I'm not saying that at all, Justice Pfeiffer. We believe that the answer is, under the Federal Arbitration Act, that the court must look to the federal rules, and that the standard as applied by the Fazio court, which is simply one articulation of what we call the touch matters standard, whether the action can be maintained without reference to the party's contract or relationship, that is a proper and acceptable articulation of the standard, and that the court may therefore announce that standard. The trick then comes in that the Court of Appeals simply, even though it stated it, didn't apply anything close to that analysis.
So, counsel, basically you're saying they applied the right standard, but they didn't apply it correctly.
No, Justice O'Connor, I think what I'm saying is that they stated or articulated the standard, but then immediately applied a different standard. They applied a let's look at the legal elements test, and that's not the same standard that it was articulated at a point earlier in the opinion.
So to prevail, you have to get us to jump over and pass the question that you're here on, address a different question. That's what my original question was about. If we stick with the question that's here,
I don't believe that that is true.
You say the answer is yes. We give you a journal entry saying the answer is yes, and everybody goes home.
I don't believe that's true, Justice Pfeiffer. I think that the court states the standard. And then, you know, courts decide cases in controversy and not.
So you do want us to go beyond the issue that's certified?
Well, there. I think we certainly want you to answer the question that was certified and then apply it to the case before the court, and we believe that that application requires
So both reversal. Sides would agree the answer is yes?
I think they would agree that a court may look to it, but I think their articulation is that the court need not look to federal standards, and we would disagree with that. We think once we've asserted a right to arbitrate under the Federal Arbitration Act, that then the federal standards apply. We don't necessarily think there's a conflict again. But in applying that, the courts of appeals, the U.S. Supreme Court in footnote 10 of the Mitsubishi opinion made it clear that domestic antitrust claims are arbitrable. These clauses that we have are the broadest possible clauses. This court in Garrick and ABM Farms said that the arising out of or relating to language is unmistakably broad, and yet in application, in the statement of the test that the Court of Appeals was using, they simply looked at an elements-based test, which doesn't look at the language and which improperly excludes from all arbitration tort and statutory claims that every other court in the country has said are plainly arbitrable. And we would ask the court for these reasons to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals, to order that the doctor's claims be arbitrated, and to stay the remainder of the case, including the claims against or claims by the associations. And again, would ask the court to reverse. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Wayne.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Richard Wayne, and along with Stan Chesley and Michael Barrett, who unfortunately couldn't be here today because he's stuck in a trial in Cincinnati, we represent the five physician named plaintiffs in this case, as well as the Academy of Medicine, which has over 2,000 members, and also the Butler County Medical Society. There are also individuals at the Ohio Medical State of Medical Association with over 20,000 members that are also interested in these issues. I think the sole issue that is really before this court is whether courts in Ohio can rely on federal standards in making its determination as to whether a claim falls within the scope of an arbitration provision. I think appellees believe that the state of Ohio, or state courts in Ohio, in determining whether or not an action or a claim falls within the scope of an arbitration provision, should begin by looking at state law. But we do believe that the courts can look at federal law as well. This is especially true in cases where the state statute is factored or created similar or modeled after a federal statute, and also when there is very little federal law or state law on the issue. In this case, in reliance on either federal or state law, it doesn't make a difference because we think that the court set out the right standard and applied the right standard. The court made a determination by beginning to look at the provider agreement to determine whether or not the claim was within the scope of the provider agreement, and it looked at the issues under both federal and state law. So therefore, the point that we would make is it shouldn't make any difference whether or not you look at federal or state law, because the statute in Ohio is modeled after the federal statute. This court has long recognized that issue, beginning with the Council of Smaller Enterprises cases in 1998, which this court adopted the four principal standard set forth in the AT&T Tech case versus Communications Workers of America. And that was a case that involved an arbitration of a collective bargaining agreement and included federal law. The test applied in that case has been followed by courts of appeals throughout the state of Ohio. For example, in the Cone versus Payne Weber case, that court utilized the smaller enterprises standards in looking at that particular case and found in a case brought by a broker against a brokerage firm that a conversion and fraudulent concealment case claim did not fall within the scope of the arbitration provision. That was the same decision that was relied upon by the Court of Appeals in this case, the Payne Weber case. The Court of Appeals also relied upon the Fazio and Ford decisions. Those decisions aren't contradictory or inconsistent with state law in Ohio. What they did was they looked at, determined whether or not there are facts giving rise to the claim and to whether the action could be maintained without reference to the contract. And they made that determination that it could be the case did not fall within the terms of the provider agreement. We think that, as the courts in the state of Ohio, as well as the federal courts have said, what you look at are the factual allegations to make sure that the factual allegations set out a claim, and you determine whether that claim falls within the scope of the arbitration provision. We think that the court did that properly.
Help me understand how you intend to prove the case under that standard. How did the rates get established, the reimbursement rates?
Well, the provider agreement, I think we've got to back up from that. The provider agreements deal with the payment to doctors for providing services on behalf of the insurance company. So a patient comes in, has something done, and you get paid for that. So the provider agreement deals with getting paid for that claim. The types of claims that would fall under the provider agreement are not getting properly paid for that particular service. Maybe the CPT code, that's the code that you get paid on, is incorrect. Maybe claims were bundled.
Okay, so these provider agreements set the reimbursement rates, correct?
The provider agreements attached to the provider agreements is a schedule of reimbursement rates. Our claim is about how the insurance companies conspired to set those rates, separate and apart from the agreement.
And how do you prove what those rates are without reference to the contracts?
Well, I think that, for example, if you have an individual that may not even have there are, in fact, some doctors that don't have arbitration provisions in their provider agreement. I think what you do is you may have to reference the fact that there was a provider agreement, but as the Court of Appeals said, the issue that we have alleged relates to the conspiracy. In the conspiracy among the insurance companies, you're never going to have to get to the provider agreement in terms of how somebody gets
paid. But I don't understand how you establish what the rates are without reference to how they got set in the provider agreements. I mean, the fact that you may have some attorneys that didn't, or some doctors that didn't have one and don't have an arbitration agreement, well, then you have a right for direct action with that because you don't have an arbitration clause. But I don't know how you can force people who have an arbitration clause to go to court just because a few other folks in the mix don't.
Well, but our point is that's one issue. The other issue is the issue on the setting rates, that's the conspiracy claim. That is a separate claim, separate and apart from the provider agreement. That is the insurance companies getting together and conspiring as to how they set insurance rates, how those rates are set. It doesn't hit the provider agreement, and if you look at the clauses, they relate to claims arising out of the agreement or the business relationship of the agreement. That's the provider agreement.
Could you prove your case if you entered none of that as evidence?
I think you could prove your case without that, because the intent of the provider agreement is to deal with doctors getting paid for services, not dealing with the underlying claims, the collateral claims, if you will, in terms of how the insurance companies have conspired to set those rates.
Counsel, looking at the issue that the parties were instructed to brief.
Yes, sir.
Your client's answer to the question is what, yes or no?
Yes. My.
So your client's answer is yes, their answer is yes. What's left for us to talk about?
Well, frankly, Your Honor, I believe that one of the statements that was just made by my opponents is that they think the standard, which I don't think is the standard was incorrectly applied. Our position is it's the right standard. Courts can, states in the state of Ohio, can look at can look at things, and as well, I don't think the second question in terms of what he talked about, I think it was correctly applied. So you can look at federal law. Courts have looked at federal law, and I think that's appropriate. I don't see the second one. I think it was the right standard, and it was correctly applied.
Counsel, I think you misstated what counsel said. He said the right standard was articulated, but another standard was applied.
Correct.
So that was the response to Justice O'Connor's question, and I think it's a subtle difference, but it's not correctly
and I
stated.
Think, sorry, and I
Thank
think
you.
What it was the right standard, and I think it was correctly applied.
Thank you.
I'd like to leave my last 4 minutes, if I could, for Mr. Chesley to talk about a couple of public policy issues, if I could.
Mr. Chesley.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, firstly, I would like to respond to Justice Stratton. Several years ago, I represented a major corporation on a price-fixing case against a vitamin manufacturer. They had a contract. It had nothing to do with arbitration. They had a binding contract for a price. But what this major, one of the largest consumer companies in the world,
did not know was that there was price fixing. So therefore, the provider agreement was intended to only handle the issues between a particular doctor relative to his reimbursement rate, how they were paid, when they were paid, whether they bundled putting claims together, where they miscoded, as opposed to having to do with the general theme of whether or not there was a conspiracy behind. And the proof of that is that in the agreements, they say you can't go for punitive. I think it's significant, Your Honors, that all, and I want to take the reverse shot, because I usually stand here as an appellant. This is a pleasure to be here as an appellee. It's a new role for me to be on this side of the table. But candidly, I want to take a look at a couple of the public policy issues on the other side. The crown jewels of the Cincinnati area are doctors who were challenged, and under an arbitration agreement, there's retaliation, there's retribution, and that's why the Cincinnati Academy of Medicine, who certainly I've fought with in other respects on the other side, came to us with the idea of saying, the court did find they had standing, and that's not in front of you, no different than the NAACP had standing in Brown versus Board of Education. They are here because, and they're not a signatory to any provider agreement, because of the great public policy issue that across the board, the doctors in the greater Cincinnati area were 30 to 50% across the board behind doctors here in Columbus, Dayton, Lexington, Louisville, and Indianapolis. And then the Ohio State Medical Society joined in an amici brief, which is in front of the court, because of the importance of the overall reimbursement, which we believe could have only come about by virtue of a conspiracy. As this court does know, two of the defendants, Humana and Aetna, have settled, and the reimbursement rates have been raised to equal Columbus, Indianapolis, and so forth over a three-year period, increasing by 30% without the use of the contract. Justice O'Donnell, I think you're right on point when you ask the question. Judge Shannon in the Payne-Weber case leaned over the bench and asked if the individual who the broker took advantage of and stole from had come into the office and got hit by the broker and fell down on the floor and died, would that be arbitrable? And the answer by the opponent was yes, which is the same point here. When you asked, are there any exceptions, there was a lot of discussion about, well, it's third party. The answer is there are exceptions, and they're valid exceptions because it's factually intensive. And one of the things that we're talking about here is evaluating whether claims should be compelled. It is well established under both state and federal law that the court should consider public policy. And public policy does not provide a basis to artificially expand the scope of the arbitration provision. In 1991, about the time the conspiracy began, the greater Cincinnati area was home to 14 regional hospitals. 9 of those 14 have closed. Since the 4 insurance carriers began to engage in their anti-competitive behavior related to medical reimbursement, Cincinnati's population has increased nearly 12%, while the number of hospitals and hospital beds have decreased by 50%. The number of doctors have left. In the addition of the American Medical News, and I believe it's in the record, the Cincinnati reimbursement rates are far below the norm for the rest of Ohio. And physicians typically can't even take a search in Cincinnati, won't even search in Cincinnati for a job. 30 to 40% below. You know, I think that there's a compelling public policy on the other side. Their suggestion on our opponents is, the public policy says we've got to enforce arbitration. And I think the answer to the question was yes, and this, the narrow issue. But I think there's an underlying groundswell here of who is there for the crown jewel doctors. I think it's interesting that while the hospitals are closing in Cincinnati because these defendants refuse to pay doctors, the defendants are perfectly willing to pay their profits. It's not really relevant, but their CEO at United last year made $94 million, and the CEO at Aetna made $46 million for their CEOs. Yet, and we're fascinated also by the amici briefs and their interests on the side of the appellants on the basis of what is best for the community. What is best for the provider network, and what is best for the people who are receiving the medical treatment. Those large, large hundreds of thousands of people who are being treated by providers who are being underpaid. And I believe that the only place and the only possibility to get to the bottom of this with the other two is a trial, and it has nothing to do with the individual provider contracts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chesley. Mr. Coleman, you saved almost 4 minutes of your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice. I would like to just make a few points in rebuttal. First, Justice Stratton, you asked the question of how do you prove your case. Well, you don't have to look any further than the plaintiff's complaint. This is not a case where you can prove liability by suggesting that a bunch of people went back into a room and made some agreement. There has to be some effectuation of this claim. And of course, we strongly dispute all of their factual allegations, but this is not the time and the place for that. What do they say about that? Well, if you look at paragraphs 2, 24, and 49 through 53 of their complaint, what they say is that this conspiracy that they allege is effectuated through these contracts. They call them improper contracts. They say that the reimbursement rates, which, by the way, are set by these contracts that contain these broad, expansive arbitration agreements, are anti-competitively too low. The only way that they can suggest that there is an effectuation of this alleged price-fixing claim is to say that they harmed us through the contracts that they entered with us. The prices that they say are fixed are the reimbursement rates set by these contracts. There is no way for them to try their case around their contract. Their brief on page 2, if you look at it, they can't even state what their claim is without referring to the contract and to the reimbursement rates.
Counsel, who negotiates those reimbursement rates?
The doctors or doctors' groups, you know, as well as the company. There are certainly standardized rates, but I think the evidence would show that there are variations.
Do the insurance companies put forth a document containing the procedures and the reimbursement rates for the physicians? That's part of the offer in the contract. They take a look at it and say, well, no, that's too low. We want to bump up those rates. Do they have the opportunity to do that, and then that becomes part and parcel of the contract?
It does from time to time happen, and I believe in this case one of the contracts has some slight differences from the other contracts.
Well, ask or answer the question in the broadest terms. Do you, the insurance carriers, the appellants here, present a document saying, here's our reimbursement schedule, take it or leave it, or do the physicians who sign on to these contracts have the ability and have they challenged those rates and said, we want them significantly higher in order for us to do business with you?
The opportunity to negotiate is there. I'm not telling you that it has changed in every case and that it's openly negotiated and different in every single contract. But the ability to negotiate.
Okay, that's not my question. My question is, are they provided with a list of what the reimbursements are going to be and they sign on to those reimbursements?
I believe that is correct, Your Honor, typically. But they are set within that contract. These public policy issues are simply an excuse for avoiding arbitration when there can't be any excuses. The Supreme Court reporters are full of cases in which the court has said Congress has spoken, and the public policy of the United States, and we believe the public policy of Ohio, is that if you agree to arbitrate, then you should arbitrate. This is not an issue of that people's rights will be denied if they go into arbitration. This is simply a change in form according to a contractual agreement. And in the end, if we cannot arbitrate these antitrust claims under our agreements, then no tort or statutory claims can be arbitrated under these very expansive agreements. And for these reasons, again, we would ask the court to reverse and to stay the remainder of the case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of opinion. Mr. Chesley, there's no more argument. Thank you.